Okay, hi everyone. Happy to be here. I'd like to just start by firstly sort of describing Slabon's staff so far for anyone who doesn't know. And then I'd just like to talk a bit about sort of my experience with Slobodan and what Slobodan means to me personally before just maybe saying what I think other people can receive from this conversation. So just to describe Slobodan's life, he grew up in communist era Yugoslavia. And he was actually a child actor and singer. He performed on television and radio. So already from a young age, he had quite an unusual life. And he really was quite famous in Yugoslavia. But in his sort of teenage years, he kind of slightly went more of his own way. And he founded a number of small independent theatres, which at the time was completely unheard of. But he also became involved with a group of people who were attempting to introduce a political party in Yugoslavia, which in the communist era wasn't allowed. So found Slobodan in some hot water, which perhaps has been a bit of a theme of Slobodan's life, if you don't mind me saying that, Slobodan. And because of this, he sort of got on the wrong side of the state slightly. He was interrogated a few times and he was followed by state officials. So because of this, Slobodan eventually fled to London, England. And Slobodan arrived in London with very little money, not speaking English, and not knowing anyone. So that's quite a terrible situation, really. And Slobodan found two jobs, one restoring icons and one cleaning stairways. But from that kind of quite simple beginning, Slobodan sort of built up his life effectively through a lot of perseverance and also some good fortune. And throughout his life, Slobodan's worked in the field of theatre and the art. Hence, the title of this conversation is Art for Social Change. And if we fast forward a couple of decades, Slobodan then moved to America, where he's continued involved in art and theatre. He's a founding figure of the Artship organization, which is still going to this day, which is an organization based in the San Francisco Bay Area that's dedicated to theatre and the arts. And recently, he's also started painting with tea. And it's quite an unusual scenario, but I'd recommend that you at least ask Slobodan about his tea paintings because they are quite interesting. But I think on a more personal note, I'd just like to talk about Slobodan that I remember. Because Slobodan met my parents when they were both living in London. And I remember as a small child, Slobodan coming to our house in London and sort of visiting us and coming to stay. And I think for me and my sister, it was always an experience to meet Slobodan. Slobodan has a big heart and he's sort of in many ways just a really incredible human being. And I mean, me and my sister used to call him Santa Claus. That kind of gives you an idea of what kind of man Slobodan is. But I can't exaggerate enough what an interesting man he is and what sort of compassion he has too. And I think for anyone sort of just listening to this call who doesn't know Slobodan or doesn't know much about him or just maybe calls every week, I think it's really worth finding the time to really listen to this conversation because Slobodan, he's just a man who's really connected to life. He's really connected to the inspiration behind life. And I think if anyone really wants to live or really wants to find inspiration in their own life, Slobodan is a man to listen to. And I'd just like to finish with a small quote from Slobodan in a recent interview he did. I've slightly paraphrased it, but it goes as follows. And Slobodan is speaking of culture here and human inspiration behind culture. Slobodan says, "There is a spark there. Everybody's called to respond to that spark. It is not something unique to artists. Everyone potentially can procreate something, a work of art or being good at a job. Culture is not something so sensitive that it belongs to the refined. It belongs to everyone." I think that's quite a neat summary of sort of what Slobodan brings to the world, and I think anyone listening to this conversation could also hopefully be in touch with that too. And yeah, that's all I'd like to
Wow, Chris, thank you. Deserves. Oh, sorry. Slobodan, welcome to the call.
Thank you very much. Now I'm speechless. It's so beautiful. I felt I didn't need to say anything, but of course I'm looking forward to it.
Yes. Yes, and whenever you get introduced as Santa Claus, you know, that tops the list of introductions.
Yeah, yeah. Well, children in the park couldn't remember my name, so they just called me Santa when we were working in urban parks in Oakland. And I was working with a Japanese man, and he was called Ninja, and I was called Santa, and it was easy to understand this.
What were you doing in the park with Ninja?
Well, we were working with in the actually toughest park in Oakland, restoring a burned amphitheater with families who gathered together to reclaim the public space, because it was the place of deals and murders. So we really started the project by just simply cleaning the place before we ever start working on memories of people's families and how they got to live in that part of Oakland.
Well, thank you so much, Slobodan, for joining us. I actually met you at the inauguration of the art ship in Oakland. I was doing puppetry at the time with my friend Jonathan Ute and some other people. And
oh,
so
yeah, yeah.
We were at the opening there, and it was great fun, a very festive event. So it's wonderful to come full circle and participate in this today. One of the things that really struck me about your career is also the aspect that I understand you were you taught architecture at UC Berkeley for a while. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is correct. Yeah, I have so many hats. I have to keep them on the little pegs on the wall. They don't fit on the head.
What made me really curious was, since you have a background as a performer and as an organizer, how do you see it? I'm curious if how you see the relationship between spaces, physical spaces like a theater or a building or some sort of, even if it's a community or a watershed, how do those physical spaces really influence and affect the type of work that's possible and needed when you're doing a community-based theater or things that relate to the commons in some kind of way?
Yeah, well, our work is very much to do with the commons. It really starts of gathering anywhere, you know, people standing on the corners because they don't have anywhere to go. It is their commons. It's how to elicit out of people congregating something which is more meaningful and which then is contained by a space. And my interest in architecture was always from people into space rather than from space fitting people into it. You know, we have the whole array of excessive buildings which are sort of art museums or places which are kind of architectural sculptures, and you can neither exhibit art or congregate in them. And I have always been interested in smaller spaces and meaningful spaces, and theater is part of it. Theater is where people come together and share the mythos, but sometimes just, you know, the daily mythos, something which one wouldn't think it's really a myth. You know, if you think of Tennessee Williams' plays, they talk about people in daily life, but the depths at which these plays go evokes the mythological and important layers of experience. And any congregating place, including the theater, can offer that.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I love that vision of theater as a way of gathering people. So often you think, I mean, as an individual going to the theater, you think of going to the theater not to gather with people really, but to see the art. And it's nice to see it from the other side as a creator
of these types of events.
On that note, Slobodan, if you could just speak a little bit about your illustrious start in theater. I mean, it's, from what we read, it was at the age of 6 and 7, and you were getting arrested in your teens, and you had to flee the country before around the age of 16. It sounds like you had an early start. It was a calling or something you just kind of felt led to do. Can you speak a little bit about your early days and your start in the world of theater?
Yeah, I'm sometimes embarrassed by the dramaticness of my story. It's a kind of, also creates sometimes a barrier, you know, it's like, but nevertheless, the kernel of it is that I was pretty isolated as a child, so my friend was a radio. I even used to embrace the radio. And I listened to everything, and I heard an audition for children performance, and I knew that is something I have to do. So when I talked to my mother, she told me then she has no time, and of course she didn't have a time. She was over busy and exhausted. And she told me I have no talent, so there is no point to do it, and I just was not going to have it. And not because I was willful, stubborn, or I just knew this is what I have to do. And so I have got myself often into huge trouble because I just knew there is something needs to be done. And I did it, and so of course it never got me a tenure anywhere or comfortable housing or any of those things which, if one keeps one's mouth shut and doesn't follow some impossible trajectory, would allow one to be a little more comfier, but I wouldn't, of course, have it any other way. Now I have calmed down, and I'm drawing with tea and ink. In a way, as a defiance to gallery system, I do them in a cafe, and I give them to people, and I scan them, and I send them, so they're kind of free. I don't sell them. But it's much more subdued than going through Congress for 5 years with basically African-American grandmothers and Latino mothers and artists and getting an Art Deco ocean liner turned military ship for Oakland for free. And then, of course, being evicted because we were introducing culinary maritime training programs addressing the crisis of perseverance, artists as models of perseverance, role models of perseverance, and so on and so forth. Well, the little tea drawings are less dramatic, I think.
So this is, just to clarify, it's, what are tea drawings?
Yeah, well, you know, I go to a tea house in Yerba Buena Garden, and they have nice teas which make a dark color. And I have 2 cups, one I'm drinking and one I'm dipping the brush in. Sometimes I make a mistake and drink the one with a little bit of ink in, and it doesn't taste as good. But I do it on Japanese paper, and I start with just lines in tea, and then they kind of like coffee grains or roshak. They give me a sense of some forms, usually organic growing things with leaves and roots and clouds and buildings and things. And they're very small, as big as a hand, so they can be easily scanned and shared.
And they're beautiful. So as a recipient of one of those, I would just, you know, I've been wowed by it. And I don't know if I've admitted this to you, Slobodan, but, you know, we get so many emails, and when they come in, we say, okay, delete or put in this folder or go over there. And all your paintings just feel, there's a feel of sacredness, and I actually just cannot get myself to delete it. So I actually have a folder with all the scanned paintings that you have sent. I mean, true story, you know. And
lovely, lovely. And you're welcome to delete it, because I send them without people needing to say, oh, this is nice, this is this and that. It just comes like a little butterfly and flitters through electronic space. And
yeah. No, they're really beautiful. Just as a follow-up, what has been your inspiration? You have done art as sort of a, you know, statement for social change. You've done it in so many different countries. You have this spirit of the commons that you're talking about. You have the spirit of really small, you know, you even just in the way you described your work in Oakland, even how these tea paintings you just kind of do and you give them to people, or you, you know, scan them and put them out, even the way you speak. There's a different quality to the work you're doing. It doesn't quite fit into the activist, you know, the typical description of an activist. I mean, your gentleness is very unique. So how can you share a little bit about what has been your motivating force and the inspiration behind the work that has guided your life?
Yeah, I wish I could say it like, oh, it's Alpha and Omega, or, you know, it's trees in my dreams, or it's this or that. It's really both the internal and archetypal presences and gifts, the amazing mentors and teachers one met, and really the activism is not the cause, it's the effect of an engagement. If one is deeply connected, and not like extraordinary, but just committedly connected to as closer to a depth as one can come, you know, humbly, but living it, then it must pour into life. One can't help it. Life and inner journey are inevitably connected. Even if one wants to separate them, I suppose some people are more suited to go and sit in a cave. I love people. That's, I suppose, I was drawn to theater because it tells people stories. But you cannot tell a people story unless you're somewhere searching, looking, touching, aspiring to the deepest sapient human intentions, and, you know, without any specific religious label. Otherwise it immediately brands it, it immediately gives it a name and limits the person who is hearing it by what they know. I always feel religious and emotional experience, one's loves and things, are something personal, something which just happens. You know, you love someone and then they go, you lose them, but they leave something, you live with it. You don't go around and talk about it. Well, it's same with a deep religious experience, and I don't even want to call it religious, but, you know, whatever the edges of meditation and aspiration, one can't name them. They just are there as something to really connect us in and out.
Can you share perhaps the first moment when you had the sense of a religious experience through the work that you were doing? Was it a...
Much, much earlier on, I was really, really a small child, and I lived in a very, very hard conditions, and the grown-ups never made sense to me. I was so upset by them. So I went under the comforter and just cried. Everything looked completely pointless. And suddenly, literally, there was something. And, you know, it will be banal to say like a light at the end of the tunnel, but figuratively, it had that quality. It was a profound presence, comforting, nameless, there. And I can always go back to it in some way. And then there are many little things like that. Then one knew that all of that confusion and poverty and hunger are not everything.
That's beautiful what you've shared. And you mentioned something about perseverance, and the way you spoke about that, I don't think I'd ever heard anyone say it the way you put it, as if you were saying that's a particular need that people have to understand or something like that. Would you say something more about that?
Well, for me, of course, because I'm in the doing and making and manifesting thing, the perseverance is about mastery. And we now know from neurologists that to be master of anything, one has to have approximately 10,000 hours of dedicated practice. But the perseverance is, again, being with one's child, who's just growing up and having all kinds of manifestations, to understand them, to stick with this child, to guide it through life. I mean, every mother faces the issues of perseverance to an existential degree. And also anybody who has to stick to a job, to make a living, these outer demands of perseverance, of course, bring the irresistible desire to be, you know, to be here, to be born, to continuity of life. Perseverance and life's continuity are incredibly linked together. There is something very natural about the perseverance. So when we erode it through electronic means, when we invade young minds with products, we are actually eroding the edges of perseverance, and we are disabling it. So my efforts in last years have been really the ecology of inner world and the mind. What are we surrounding our children? How many kills and booms and explosions they see by the time they're five? Then we are surprised when somebody goes into a cinema and does something, because we are numbing this very, very vital flow of internal perseverance.
That's really beautiful what you've said, and what I'm hearing you say is that the central impulse of a person who's a normal person, who isn't distracted by the things that are invading our minds, the advertising, all the other stuff, that the natural movement would be, as you said, to be here, to be born.
Yeah.
That is the heart of our inner trajectory if we're only supported somehow in that. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. And I suppose this call is like that. People are gathered around values which need to be cherished and nurtured. I was so impressed by the sharing. It all comes from real life, from real moments. It's not fantasy of grandeur, it's fantasy of sharing. Not fantasy, reality of sharing.
Yes.
Not fantasy of grandeur, it's reality of sharing.
There's this beautiful little video on YouTube that Slobodan made. It's called Gift to... I think it's called Gift to Charity Focus or Gift to Service Base. It's a little over a minute long. Do you know which one I'm talking about, Slobodan?
Oh, yeah, I love doing that. That was my gift to Napoon. He just sent to me.
Oh, it's so beautiful, and it will show everybody. I think it will show everyone your tea drawings.
Oh, yeah, it's all made of tea drawings. But it's really just from the words of what Nipun used to call his organization. I really loved doing that.
Did you do that entire thing yourself, Sloboda?
No, I was helped electronically. You know, I'm not savvy, but I directed it. You know,
timing,
everything, but I didn't know exactly what to click and,
and
how to
just
put it. But I knew how long and what music and which drawings and how to fade, those kind of things.
Well, it's a masterful piece of work, I think. It's so beautiful. And if you Google Slobodan Danpei, you'll find it probably on the first page of the Google search. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I never do that.
I just searched for it right now, and it's called Gift from Slobodan
Danpei. Oh, good, because it was
it's on YouTube, actually,
yeah,
where I found it.
It shouldn't be my name because it really was a gift.
Give,
people said they Googled themselves. I have never Googled myself. I'm not superstitious, but, you know, I don't know. Why would I Google myself? All kinds of things might tumble out.
Well, there's a lot of Slobodan Danpei out there. Let me tell you, Slobodan.
Yeah. Well, I leave it to you people. To look at this.
That's
maybe
great.
One day I peep, but
the range of things that you've been involved with is pretty impressive, and I'm wondering what sorts of things you are working on now.
Yeah, there is a whole other life I have, and that is history of art and ideas. And I have been writing papers mostly for academic conferences to make the links which have been broken or systematically negated through nationalism, chauvinism, or other phenomena which is so endemic within the academia, and it's all under this guise of being objective. So currently I'm writing a paper about the osmosis behind the Crusades for a conference, Domino Effect in the Mediterranean, which will be in Istanbul, and I'm showing the incredible intercultural relationships. People do relate. They are not. History is not about conquest and conquered. It's about how it all flows between. So I'm going to 8 conferences from September to January. I will be in beautiful, dynamic Istanbul, full of people of the world, and working there also on a small exhibition and gathering some people to do a spontaneous performance. We did that last year. I was there too. And then I will be going to Taiwan and very important conference in Tunisia on the education of the future and so on and so forth. So I have done since 2005 34 different papers and been to all these conferences. And of course at my age my second name becomes jet lag, but it's worth it because and you know I get some dismissive arguments from my colleagues saying, well, you're an artist, you really don't know, you can't say that. But also people invite me because in some way I'm the only one who can say it, because I don't care, I'm not looking for tenure, I'm not looking for anything. I think these bridges have to be made, and I'll help a little if I can.
Richard, if I can actually put you on the spot, you had said in the sort of preamble to your interview that just meeting Slobodan and interacting with him, somebody you didn't know too much about, but just over that conversation, you said this is one of the most interesting guys I've ever met.
Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit about what was it about meeting Slobodan that...
Well, it would be... I have a pretty good intuition. I trust my intuition, and so far it's pretty steered me pretty well. I just grasped rather quickly that the sort of breadth and depth of Slobodin's life, the completely unusual nature of his life, and the depth to which he's been pursuing some kind of inner vision, which I sort of intuitively just felt is needed, truly needed by us today. The specifics of it were beautifully laid out by Chris at the beginning, the introduction, I think. I mean, you can see the all the different things that Slobodin has been through, and I think I've only scratched the surface. I mean, Slobodin, I think you mentioned or somebody mentioned, well, when we met with Alyssa Renault, who's a wonderful person, also an old friend of Slobodin's, that when you were in Oakland with your artship organization there, that you had helped somehow 5,000 art events take place, something like that. And that's just one small little part of your life.
Yeah, well, that was a project of the windows. We adopted the enormous amount of empty store windows and exhibited whoever wanted to exhibit. That was an informal art school behind the scenes. And over 10 years, we had 5,000 little window installations, exhibits. A number of people's careers started because the galleries wouldn't have them, but then they found their way, and we, of course, didn't charge. We had tiny little grants, and we just did that nonstop, day and night. And every single artist was handled individually as if it was their own one-person show. The moment in time for them to present themselves, and it was open to anybody. It was in the street, 24 hours, day and night. You can see it. You can just pass by and look with the corner of your eye. And it really was the moment where Oakland turned from being a derelict downtown into, and of course soon become yuppified and all the gentrified and all those things, but it started with...
Well, this is just remarkable. I mean,
yeah.
And the spirit in which you do these things, the spirit of generosity and service that's so clear. The phrase that Prakash used earlier in our check-in, that there's life before death. I would say that this is such a great such a great phrase, and that I just thought, no, I bet Slobodin will really like that phrase.
Yeah, I love it, yeah. And imagine if it continues afterwards in some distilled form. Then
yeah.
Absolute engagement.
Slobodin, before we go to the next call, which is in the queue, I did want to ask you about fear, because one of the things when Chris was describing you, and he said, you know, Slobodin has known my parents back in Europe, and one of the things that I remember from having known him was that man just does not have any fear. Like, he would just, you know, that was the impression that others had of you. Can you speak a little bit to fear, what has been something that has challenged you in that way, and how you've overcome that? Maybe it's a situation.
No, I understand the question, and of course I have fear. Good Lord, everybody has fear. You know, some people are just foolhardy and they bang their heads against the world. But it is, I think, overcoming fear, it's in every situation. It is, you know, a constant something, and sometimes one is better at it and sometimes one just can't help it. And again, it should be a byproduct, you know. If one is so, you know, cavalier, whatever is the word, so one appears of not having fear and one cultivates that, like, you know, I have no fear. Well, it's like we are all vulnerable. We are all just trying our best.
But Was there a moment, Slobodan, when you were able to conquer even a little fear? I mean, fear, to conquer fear in its ultimate sense is grandiose, but perhaps you can share an anecdote when life challenged you and you were able to overcome that with your spiritual practice, perhaps.
Well, I think this is a daily thing. It's not like... And it might not be called fear. It's not like then one is trembling. But I don't have a dramatic example of it. It isn't that I was so fearful then. I mean, when I was a child, that example of being upset. But I think fear is something one needs to work on all the time. Because fear is the other side of love. It's not hate. Fear. So if one is engaged with love, the fear is there, and it just is a process. An emptiness, an ontological fear in front of the unknown, it's part of the meditation. It's the warm-up of the meditation. It's the breathing in and looking beyond and hoping that the beyond would be with us. But I think it's also important to accept that if one is fearful and one doesn't have an answer and one is having a difficult time and one doesn't know if one is going to have a job or not have a job or if it is a medical situation or anything, it is okay not to be strong. It is okay to have fear. It is okay to be vulnerable, because there one is really true to oneself. Then something might happen. And I have had many, many of those, humbly just, stewing in my own juices and my own makeup and my own limitations.
Thank you.
There's a quote.
Go ahead.
There's a quote somewhere I found from you, Slobodan. Having nowhere to go, one might arrive.
Mm. Oh yeah, that's my refugee experience. When you have nowhere to go, where do I arrive? Into nothing. But it's so comforting.
Slobodan, thank you so much for the. For this gift of your, let's say, wonderful wisdom. I felt, as you were speaking, I felt it was like a symphony of words flowing. Thank you. And thank you for receiving this reflection and the question. When I saw that beautiful email from the forest farmer, this invite, the first a thought I had looking at you, that beautiful smile and the beard was that it brought the picture of the Santa. And when Chris shared his that beautiful introduction, it really brought it completed the full circle. My question is more of a reflection. I want to invite you to sort of join along. Is what does the warden's mind is occupied these days? What are those things that come up quite a bit in your mind?
Well, a little bit what I was saying about these papers and the conferences. This is very much on my mind, these themes and issues, and I live with them and I struggle with them and I care for them. So it's really through these papers that one addresses the issues. After we lost our beautiful, beautiful ship, all doors were closed. I mean, nobody really, except two foundations who really care for our work, calliope mostly and tithes. Nobody really came forward and said, okay, no ship, what can we do? So I really turned to these papers because people out there suddenly start inviting me.
Mm-hmm.
So the world has a room for this thought. It just isn't, you know, in the immediate environment, because the immediate environment is closed in its own cliches or, you know, values. So my thoughts are how to answer those calls from those other places the best I can.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter if it's hard to get there and, you know, how to do 8 papers in the prescribed time but not to rush them and made them superficial. All of those kinds of things are on my mind. And of course, always not just planning, but incubating the next performance, the next exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
We have booked the wooden amphitheater in Berkeley Botanical Gardens for the longest day of the year next June. So we will be performing there. It's such a beautiful place, and it's suitable for the poetic, archetypal, dream-like work. It's in a redwood forest, tiny redwood forest, a wooden amphitheater.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the things I'm thinking about, but not just by myself, with other people. We are trying the songs, the stories they like. It's kind of emerging.
Thank you
so much,
and we wish you continued best health, and thank you for gifting your, you know, work of art.
Oh, and thank you.
Our next caller is from Boston. Audrey, take it away from the East Coast.
Hi. I have like a bunch of questions swimming in my head right now, but two of them I was thinking of while you're speaking are. I've been thinking about the kind of like the creative process and the artistic process, and I was wondering if you could share a bit about like where you find inspiration or what inspires you, and then also when you're kind of going through the process of creating something, what do you do in those moments when you feel uninspired or when you feel stuck?
We live in the culture which puts creativity first. You know, you can go to creativity workshop and you stretch your arms and you take this or that. Well, my approach to creativity has always been creativity is a byproduct of problem solving. I'm not seeking some ecstasy where I'm now being creative and then I'm being stuck. I'm problem solving.
Mm-hmm.
And then the moment of epiphany, the connection happens because I'm engaged with something. It might be a social problem, it might be artistic problem, it might be ink, it might be how a person moves, how to choreograph something. What is the real depth of the story, and so on and so forth. And if you go to the Artship website, there is a paper called Arts and Science, Creativity in Art and Science, and it really explores to a considerable depth the whole issues of creativity. But if one feels stuck, it is just to go to something which one needs to resolve, which would unstuck one. I don't know if that makes sense. You know, if you're writing something or drawing and you feel, I'm stuck, well, start another one. I don't want to give advice because that can sound, patronizing or as if I know something.
But have you ever had a moment where you felt stuck and like had to work through that?
Yeah, but you just
share one.
You don't get paralyzed, you don't get stuck. I mean, of course you're stuck. It's same like fear. You're stuck, you're unstuck. You just don't get stuck. I mean, you do. I mean, I do. Everybody does. It's just the way how one wiggles out of it. And each person does it according to their own temperament. So in my case, I always try to wiggle out of any shackles. And so, you know, Slobodan means freedom. It's the word which means freedom. So they branded me. And then they complained, my parents, and I was too restless and impossible. But block means shackle. We have to find the internal freedom, some kind of little movement which gets us out. And if nothing else, one can sing in shackles.
Do you have a practice, Slobodan, of when you personally get stuck to come out of that, or do you just be with that and allow it to kind of unfold?
Yeah, I don't have a methodology. I just know there is no time to be stuck, but now one is stuck, then let's be unstuck within the issue where one got stuck.
That's a practice. That's a practice. We'll go into our
kind of practice, but I only articulated it now. Yeah. It isn't then I put it on my fridge and say, get unstuck when you're stuck by going back to the stuck. No.
You know, it's kind of great, this thing about if you're sort of stuck and you're kind of be there for a while, at least you can sing.
Yeah, that's my that was my always idea. If one is completely chained and you know, there is no hope for anything, well, of course they can, somebody can put, but you can still sing even if they put a tape over your mouth.
We have two more questions, and if you have a question, hit star 6. We may be able to get one more in after these two, but we'll go to the next caller here.
I was struck by that sentence earlier on in the call where you said theater is where people come together and share daily myths, and I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about what the importance of myth is in today's world.
Yeah, actually, every story is, it's a myth. You know, if you tell about your grandmother, if you knew her, or someone, just a story they, and even if it's an ordinary story, she went by train and she found that, in sheer narrating, in sheer communication of retelling something, it evokes the archaic level. It invokes a timeless level, which are kind of transpersonal, where the experiences can be shared. And that's the power of story, just the story itself. So I believe the layer of every story is a mythos. And of course, if one analyzes the stories and wants to put them in categories, which I never would, because one can say, oh yeah, this is a mythos of the wise old movement, of the innocent child, or, you know, depending on what category of myth, or one can say Hindu myth and say, oh, this is like Shiva, Brahma, or this is like Zeus or Hera, you know, because within each story there is of course an archetypal layer, but over insisting on it can make itself conscious. If the story flows and reaches the hearts and the minds of others, there is the myth. And some friends who have worked among the refugees and global poor have told me that very young people are rediscovering the oral tradition. They have no other means by telling, retelling, and remembering. And in ancient times, people can remember so much. Their capacity was extraordinary. And the shepherds would know thousands of songs. And of course, we have shrunk that because we have fed it to machines. So the mythos lives in the, it's an organic part of the sapient reality of being a conscious human.
Very beautiful. One last question on from Washington, D.C. Bela, take it away.
Hi. So my question kind of goes back to what Audrey was asking. And I'm just curious to know more about the experience of being an artist. And more specifically, how does your art in all of its forms help you to be with your truest self? You know, how does it help you to embrace your vulnerability?
Oh, I wish I know, but I'm just thinking, what is your profession?
I guess I would say I work in international education, whatever that means.
No. It's same like art, you know. Art is like international education. Or like nursing, or like being a doctor or something. You know, it's not any different. It is just an engagement in the world. It is put on some pedestals, or it presumes something. But it's a job. Yes, one is passionate about it, and there are some jobs which one is not passionate as much. But I have known some extraordinary nurses. Both as a child, the women who were really rescuing half-frozen children abandoned after the war, and I sort of shared space with them. And in various countries where I live, are people who are so dedicated to help patients. Then that was their passion. They really transcended the profession. So any profession gives us both the grind, you know, it's the sandpaper which makes us a pebble. And so the art too. It's not different.
Everything is art.
Yeah, everything is art, and also art is a job. You know what I mean?
That's great. We're just on the last couple minutes here of the call.
Well, I'm just so grateful, Slobodan, for what you've shared. The introduction, you did a lot of interviews while you were at ArtShip in Oakland, and you can go to YouTube sort of Google Slobodan on YouTube and you'll get these interviews, and there's an introduction that's so beautiful, and the voiceover is something like this: preparing the way for generations, spinners of dreams and visions, like mystic magic messages in bottles, like a prayer or a confession. ArtShip is our canvas. We will prepare the way. ArtShip, ArtShip. It's beautiful.
Oh, thank you. That was made out of 25 poems of different people, and then they took a word here and there and made that, and then I just read it.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, well, I've been so moved by the things that you've shared today, and especially also by your voice, which is just hypnotic and so relaxing. It's clear to me that you have really done a lot of work to really embody the things that you believe in, and that's something I will take from this call and really I find it very admirable, and I'm excited to get to learn more about you today and look forward to following what you're doing. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Well, thank you all.
And I think Sam and Richard speak on behalf of all of us, saying what a gift it was to have you amongst us. So let's close with a minute in silence in the spirit of gratitude, you know, for Slobodan giving his time so generously and sharing his wisdom and, you know, all the forest farmers on the back end that are trying to juggle all the different pieces and all of you that have tuned in from all across the world. Thank you for holding this space and sharing it and co-creating something beautiful together. I'll break the silence in just about a minute. Thank you again. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Slobodan.
Thank you, Slobodan.
And we even have.
And thank you all. Thank you so much.